that part. So we did a lot of the basic skill set training for these people, so they knew enough to stay out of the way if anything else.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And what were your reactions to so many countries united in one cause, the coalition?
It was pretty amazing. You know, it was one of these things you felt really part of history. Because when I went to Bahrain with the Commodore at the first sort of naval conference we had, it was just almost overwhelming. We were living in a 5-star hotel. We took over the ballroom or the big reception room that they had, and they had tables set up in rectangular sort of shape, and each senior representative of each country's Navy sat at the table, and folks like me were your operations officers sat one chair behind. And then you saw the dialogue starting between, obviously, the navies as to what contribution could be done and when could ships arrive in theater. It was a very deliberate dialogue here that went on for a couple of days. But to see all this, you know, presence in one place was amazing. I mean, I remember watching Australian Commodore, funny enough, arrived in his blue jeans, cowboy boots, and hat because his luggage never made it to Bahrain, I think, ever. And so we went out to try to buy a clean shirt and pants and sat there to say, wow, you know, this person came all the way from Australia, we came all the way from Canada, you know, in the Arabian Gulf to discuss what will our individual countries contribute to this effort. It was, it was really fascinating. This is certainly a clear memory that I have, watching, you know, in awe, this huge, massive congregation of senior admirals and commodores looking at this issue.
And was there problems? Because a lot of the countries had rules and regulations and policies set by their government, so some countries would give more than others.
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, and because that was a really an interesting part of the stories which I like to recount sometimes when people talk about coalition work. Not all countries came to the table with a very clear understanding yet as to how much rope, if you wish, that their countries would let them have. For some, it was a fact-finding visit. For some, there was a clear decision to engage like we did, but what kind of combat mission, what area of the Gulf, what kind of risk factor the nation was willing to accept was not clear all around. And in fact, at one stage, I think the discussion after day one of our little conference, there was a natural break here. And I had met my U.S. counterpart, who obviously was trying to generate a bit of clarity in some of those issues. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll invite all the operations officers in my hotel room, and we'll have a chat at our level, commander level. And funny enough, I ended up in a huge suite. And I think that was an administrative error. The Commodore was given a regular, really nice room. I think I was given one royal suite in the hotel. You only find out on the last day. So I choked at me. But I had this huge room that I could actually almost hold a conference. So I gathered everybody in the good old Canadian fashion. I ordered 2 cases of beer, and I ordered some stationery, foolscap paper. And I said, folks, you know, there's 2 things we need to understand. What kind of limitation do you think your countries might impose on you? Nevertheless, it's an unfair question at this early stage, but we need to understand the dynamics. And will your rules of engagement allow you to defend your friends or just yourself? That's a very basic tenet of rules engagement here. And based on that, we ended up with almost a perfect mosaic of groupings of ships as the first go-around if everybody showed up deployed in theater at the time. So we knew an example that we had to pay particular attention. And then the conversation evolved in these 2 basic questions, things like communication capacity, who has satellite communication, who has not. Little cultural things, little historical things, like we might want to be careful to put the British frigate side by side in a surface action group with an Argentinian frigate.
Oh, yeah.
There was still a lot of short-term history here, you know. Eventually, in fact, these things work themselves out, but we have to be careful. And but the restrictions, I think, were very much the exploration stage, but we were able to get a clear enough view of who could go all the way up to the top of the Gulf, who would clearly flex muscle, who would probably have to convince their government to give them a little more leeway. And that was fun. That was really fun. That was one of those incredible meetings where you've got all these, you know, dozens of international counterparts, and they're, okay, guys, let's talk Turkey here. Mm. You know, are you going to defend me if suddenly a missile's coming my way, or are you just going to step aside and hope it doesn't hit you?
At this point, did you believe that the Canadian government would let the Navy take an offensive role with the Americans?
Well, we really didn't expect to have, quote, an offensive role, unquote, because once again, the type of ships that we had and the armament that we had was very defensive. And the role that we undertook became very clear as we did our analysis, was very much to be very flexible in doing maritime interdiction operation. I mean, offensive in that area only meant, quite frankly, to support a land campaign, because as soon as the hostilities started, the little bit of Navy that was in the top, you know, northern part of the Gulf kind of went alongside, shut down, or some stuck their nose out, were sank very quickly. There was not a big Navy-Navy competition. What there was is a huge job of trying to control all the traffic that was going in the Gulf and enforce United Nations sanctions.
What did you think of when, in Ottawa, they told Commodore Summers to put the Army, the Navy, and the military into one, which is called the J-Staff.
And yep. Mm-hmm.
What was your reactions? Do you believe this was a good idea?
I believe it was, but I tell you, it was a shock. I had been seconded to the Commodore staff, as I explained, just to initially to provide a little bit more brain power applied to specific piece of the planning. And when we actually arrived in the Gulf, the morning we got to Manama, I said to the Commodore, well, boss, I think my job is done. I mean, I've done all the extra work I want to do, and I guess I'd love to stay, but I don't see myself really fitting well in this staff process here. I'm a bit of an extra leg here on the stool, so whenever you say so, I'll pack my bags and go home and carry on with babysitting my ship and refit. And he said, well, hang on a minute. Let's make sure there's nothing else we haven't talked about or thought about. And within about 48 hours, the whole issue of increasing the Canadian Forces' presence in the Gulf came up. And he was asked to fly to Ottawa to discuss this. And being his ops officer, his operations officer, he said, and you're coming with me. So within hours, we're on a plane to Canada. We met the National Defense Headquarters crisis action team that was stood up for this, and obviously the chief of defense staff of the day had probably made up his mind that he was going to try to have a model of joint operation. Very new in the sense that seasoned folks like the Commodore had never operated in the joint environment, didn't even understand the lexicon of joint operation. I myself had just graduated about a year and a half before from Staff College. I had a little brochure about, a quarter of an inch thick from my course that talked about how to organize yourself in the joint staff, but not much meat. But it made sense in the sense that you want to have one voice for Canadians operating in the Gulf, and I think that's where we obviously focus our effort. So I suddenly morphed from being an extra senior staff officer on the fleet staff at sea to being asked to cross over and become the Deputy Chief of Staff Operations for the whole Middle East Force and Bahrain.
And your responsibilities when you...
I went from Navy to Joint, basically. Okay. And that was also an incredible rush, because not only do we have to create a Joint staff out of nowhere. We had no headquarters, we had no communication, we had nothing. we had no terms of reference for the individual positions in that joint staff. So I went and sequestered myself in a hotel room for 2-3 days, trying to create this construct. And then with some help, folks from Ottawa who sent an early part of a reconnaissance mission, we went and set up a headquarters.
In Bahrain?
In Bahrain.
And did you want the headquarters in Bahrain? Because there was a lot of talk about Iraqis sending missiles over to Bahrain, and you other places could have been Abu Dhabi or Dubai. Did you feel this was a good place?
Well, I'm sure Commodore Summers has a little bit more insight on some of the discussions that he had at his level, but Gulf Cooperation Council countries were tentative as to how much foreign troops they wanted on the ground. Bahrain had been a little bit more receptive. What helped as well is that the Middle East, the U.S. Navy kept a small Middle East staff in Bahrain. In fact, the commander even lived ashore with his family before the Gulf War. So, you know, we had a natural affinity here of discussing with the senior sailor from the U.S. Navy all our plans and our thoughts and how we would evolve the coalition. So for us, it was natural. And you remember the first few weeks of this, there was no land campaign. It was all maritime interdiction. I mean, we went for 3.5 months without firing a bomb or weapon because we were enforcing UN sanctions, and UN sanctions were on the water in the Gulf. So it made eminent sense. I think when we went from basically that to the next stage of the hostilities that started in mid-January 16th, if my memory serves me right. Then we could have considered moving and should have considered moving. And I think we were criticized a lot for not having moved. Where, quite frankly, the other nations grew their staff exponentially at that time. We didn't. But even in retrospect, for what we were asked to do and what our mission was, we were at the right place. Where it became a little messy is trying to manage the expectation of the Air Force capability we had done in Qatar and the pressure that we put on them as a national headquarters versus their coalition friends of the Air Force who wanted them sometimes to do something else. So being in Saudi Arabia would have been easier at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's easy to look at it afterwards. But we thought we were doing the right thing.
When, after the 6 months of the three ships, there's talk of sending the crew back to Canada and bringing in a brand new crew flown in by the Air Force. Did you think this was a good idea of having to train them all over again? Or were you fighting to keep them still there?
They did it for one ship. They actually turned over the crew of the supply ship.
Yeah, Protector.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah. I think we've learned over the years, and I've had several postings following this episode of my life. In fact, that kind of set me up on the track of joint operation for most of my career after this. And I've seen countless missions overseas where after 6 months you realize that people are burnt out. You really need to walk away. And you need a finite date in your mind. Otherwise, you know, you're going and going and so having a target is important. But to put it in the context of a ship, it's tough. And what was considered at the time was that we did not have necessarily enough equipment in our transition to a new Navy, with new frigates coming up and the travel up there, enough equipment to re-equip again a different batch of ship, totally, and bring it into a theater. You know, the transit is almost a month. So it didn't make more sense to actually sort of quarantine the ship alongside for a while, change the crew, do a bit of training, go in the remote part of the Gulf where the threat is less, and then build up the expertise and go again. And that was the thinking at the time. I'm still not sure that's the right thing. Because there's a sense that's hard to capture. People don't seem to understand that. Those who don't go to sea in ships, there's a ownership piece. And it's your ship, and to give it to a stranger and say, you know, use it, don't break it, I'll take it back in 6 months, is a really tough one. And I think navies have been wrestling with that at large. The American Navy has done a couple of swaps around the Gulf, and I think politically it sounds good. I think at the end of the day, the success may not have been all that great.
Was this the first time that Canada's ever had a switch?
To my knowledge, it is, but I've never really researched that question.
When was your duty tour over?
I came back. Let me just look at my note here, because you prepped me for some of the questions. I literally went back to my little bit of diary here. I came back, I think it was the 10th of February, and that was a tough one, because I had left with that ship of mine in refit, and it got to the stage where the refit was coming to an end, and we needed to do some very important training with the crew to meet the expectation of the contractor and the expectation of the Crown to get the ship ready for operation by a certain time. So I got relieved. And it was somewhere around 10th of February, and I can verify that here. And then went home from there just in time to basically see the wrap up with the ceasefire. So I missed the last 10 days or so of the operation. And the person that replaced me barely had time to find out his job and to walk around and meet to know his counterpart. And wrapped up and came home too. So, but not having been there for the actual ceasefire,
yeah,
it's something that I'm really sad about, because you have so much emotion and energy invested for so long.
It's that ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the team, because we had a ragtag team of, I built this joint staff as well, and I have the joint operations staff, and I had the J2 section intelligence, J3 operations, J5 plans. And they were truly a tri-service team, and that never worked before. And to mold them into a team and have them, perform, and there was a great camaraderie here with that staff. I was feeling I was abandoning them as I walked away. And I said, the good thing is that basically things got wrapped up fairly quickly after, so it wasn't as bad. But I wasn't there for the big day.
Yeah. What do you think the Canadian Navy learned from this operation, being in the Gulf? For instance, you said that the J staff, brand new, has learned that. But also, was there anything else that they learned?
Well, I think the Navy relearned and was able to confirm again to itself and obviously to the leadership that the Navy is a very flexible instrument of national power. The fact that we're able to sail across an ocean and two seas while still negotiating what the role would be is something that nobody else can do. You can't go plunk aircraft down on the ground somewhere or move troops on the ground somewhere and say, pause, we'll wait here for a few days and decide what the political role is. Ships can turn around, they can stop. You can adjust your timelines here based on obviously the success or failures of diplomatic negotiation. We also learned that, and we kind of knew that, but this really confirmed that despite the fact we did 10 days of tremendous retrofitting, you more or less have to sail the way you are. So, yeah, we splice new equipment on board, but the readiness of the sailors, the readiness of the power plant, the general preparedness of the ships are not going to change that much. So the Navy must always have a readiness system where some ships are tagged to be able to go somewhere in a hurry. And sometimes that's the way you're going to enter the fight. This is, seems logical, but it's something in our funding lines and our business planning cycle we've had to fight time and time again as a force to say, well, you cannot decide you're going to ramp up again. You've got to have that capability. Now, we have ships in this harbor right now today that can sail in 12 hours and never come back. know, so that's the kind of readiness that you need. We also knew we desperately needed new ships, and there was the frustration that was confirmed here as to the kind of fight that could have been, the kind of home that could have been. We if this happened a year later, we would have a totally different fleet out there. We would have, you know, tribal destroyers, frigates, and certainly our role would have been very different. Our option, at least, of role would have been very different. But it's interesting, when you look at it today, we're back in the same cycle. You know, 17 years ago, we were there, and now we're about the same way. We're now at a stage where our frigates are going to be upgraded. Our tribal destroyers are basically dying of old death, of old age. AORs could not withstand another war. And all we can hope now is that the message continues to be passed. You know, the sooner we can replace our Navy, the sooner we can have that card in our national inventory of options to move on.
It would be amazing if we had the same kind of money and the government put it into as the United States do, because then we'd have a full package.
Yeah, I mean, the strength of the Canadian Navy has always been, because we're small and because we're, you know, obviously dollar limited, we're innovators and we're trying to squeeze all we can out. But at the same time, I should also add that what we also learned and relearned is the quality of our sailors was very good and is very good. In fact, the strength was the quality of our sailors.
One of the best in the world, Commander Doug.
Absolutely, and our training is good, and our ability to work with other nations. You know, the typical Canadian compromise, you go into an area. I mean, what did I know about the Middle East? What did I know about, you know, working with 20 navies? I didn't. And I found myself in my hotel room, sort of, you know, drinking beer with these guys and negotiate kind of a, you know, a partnership. And you saw this all level. You know, we had a very small air staff in Saudi Arabia working with the Allied Air Forces. Well, there's three or four individuals were able to sway sometimes a huge portion of the planning effort of the coalition. Because they would say, hang on, not be afraid to raise their hand and say, we're new here, but we look at this whole issue, and how about this? Why don't we do this instead? And so it is in our Canadian psyche, I guess, to question, but also at the same time to try to referee, and team building, I guess, is probably the best word I can use. Seems to be have a knack to go in and be able to build a team.
And so I guess you're not very happy with the Canadian government and the way they've probably treated the Navy since then, would you say?
Well, you know, we did afterwards, I mean, on the eve of the Gulf War, we did get the delivery of our ships. We built, I think, in the 1990s, a very formidable Navy again, huge capability. But as always, we seem to have a problem that people understand that if you're going to maintain a Navy, you cannot sit 30 years or 20 years even, and then wake up to the fact you need to replace it. So it's that message that's hard sometimes to be consistent. When you have a political system that goes, you know, with an horizon of one or two elections versus a sustainment view of 30 years. But we're coming out again to the doldrum. I mean, we have now announced a joint support ship program, which is basically the AOR replacement with some capability to support troops. We also have the Halifax class modernization that it's well on its way now for the approval process, and I 100% believe that approval will come in the next few weeks, and we'll see a massive retrofit to these Halifax class frigates, the same way as we dealt with the tribal in my days. So, you know, once again, we'll upgun, change technology, and so on those vessels. That will keep us going for another 10 to 15 years. But at the same time, now we need to push and continue to have now the follow-on, so we don't get to end of life of those vessels without something coming in on the waterfront. So, it's, you know, it's unfortunately that's the typical way that this country is operated. We have not been able to formulate and to support a continuing shipbuilding program. And that's very expensive, quite frankly. Not doing that. Not having a continuing shipbuilding program is very expensive. Because you've got to recreate the infrastructure, you've got to hire, find and hire the brain power that knows how to do this kind of very complex project management. So you've got a very slow start, steep learning curve, then you deliver, and then we allow it to atrophy again, which is not a good way to do business.
No. And finally, is there anything you'd like to add or mention about the Persian Gulf War?
Well, a couple of things. I think history later will realize this was a significant page in our naval history, although not as glamorous, but the fact that we didn't lose ships, we didn't go and bombard people ashore, we didn't go in there and basically kill the enemy. What we did show clearly is the flexibility of sea power, and the fact we're able to put the Canadian flag in a foreign area and influence the events. The other part that I just mentioned briefly is this was also the creation of our joint thinking. Very difficult transition for us, given the fact that we employed the Army, Navy, and the Air Force around there, really working with three separate pieces of the coalition. And Commodore Summers was really the national military commander that tried to orchestrate some of these things, but he did not direct combat operations directly. His subordinate did. But since then, we've continued to explore and evolve to the point where the central staff in Ottawa is now very much structured under the joint process. In fact, because of my experience in 1990-91, in 2000, I was selected as the chief of staff for joint operation for the entire Canadian Forces as a Commodore, and I led all the staffing planning and effort that led to our first deployment in Afghanistan. I negotiated a mission for Eritrea and Ethiopia. I was involved in the drawdown discussion of our troops in Bosnia. So, his was a sailor who was actually dealing with frontline army issues. And I had my tenure in that job for 2 years. I dealt with 22 operations overseas and four or five in Canada of significant size, like the G8 Summit, Summit Americas, and so on. So the culture has changed, and I think what we now see is typically in our career progression is a ricochet back and forth between, in our case, naval expertise and naval jobs, and then going into joint operations or strategic joint planning. And so this was really the creation of our joint thinking. Based on a very small operation, localized in Manama, Bahrain, with a bunch of folks that try and make it work. But it's a significant transition, I think, in our little history of forces.
Oh, definitely. I didn't know. No clue. But thank you very much. Thank you, sir.
It's a pleasure, John.
And